This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. John will be back with you on Monday. But in the meantime, we've got a lot to get to this hour. A look at movies hitting theaters this weekend. A truly remarkable and disturbing story of a British businessman who made millions selling fake golf ball finder-style bomb detectors all over Iraq. We'll also look at the future of commuting by tube. No, no, not the London kind. We're talking about passenger car-sized vacuum tubes. And until that day comes, we want to know, how do you manage your commute?
This is Rich Paisner from Minneapolis, and the best part of my commute is listening to Books on Tape. It really takes me away from the frustration of traffic and the length of my commute.
Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE to tell us. But first, after 3 weeks of silence, NSA leaker Edward Snowden has been talking to a team of international human rights workers, all this playing out from his temporary base in a Moscow airport. Joining us is Ellen Barry, Moscow correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Ellen.
Hello.
Ellen, we understand after this meeting that Edward Snowden is asking for temporary asylum in Russia, an asylum he had already asked for before. What's going on?
The question of whether he was seeking asylum in Russia had been a little bit murky because we have not heard from him directly until now. And Vladimir Putin's press secretary had said that he had been interested, but then he changed his mind and was not seeking asylum. Well, today we know definitely. He said that his ultimate destination is Latin America, but for the time being, the only safe place for him is Russia. So he was asking about a dozen people who he invited to see him to make the case to Mr. Putin on his behalf to grant him asylum in Russia.
Vladimir Putin said in the last round of this that the Russian government might grant asylum, but only if Edward Snowden ceased his leaking that was damaging to U.S. Intelligence efforts. Could those conditions still be met? Is that offer still in play?
So indeed, those conditions were reiterated after Mr. Snowden's announcement today. Dmitry Peskov said, yes, if he's willing to agree to those conditions, then hypothetically he might be able to stay. And Snowden himself addressed this question during the meeting, saying that he essentially saw no obstacle in the condition because he did not view his actions as being harmful to U.S. interests. But the passage of time makes it less and less likely that he will get a permanent home in Latin America because it simply gives more time and opportunity for negotiation between Washington and those capitals. And also the question of his travel continues to be, I think, a huge headache.
Still, Ellen Barry, none of this does anything to change the sort of difficult political situation that Russia or Vladimir Putin find themselves in. If they deny the asylum request, it looks like they're kowtowing to American interests. And if they accept it, it looks like they're picking a fight.
Right. I mean, I think in this case it is Russia is a little bit stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I do think that Putin's conditions, which he articulated almost 2 weeks ago, were an attempt to stake out a neutral position and avoid being forced to say yes or no, because, in fact, neither answer is a real win for Russia right now.
Before we let you go, Ellen Barry, did the human rights activists who met with Ed Snowden have anything to say to you about how he's been living in this transit zone, either what he looked like, or did they have any insight into what he's been doing with his time, where he's been sleeping, how it's been?
So what we heard from people, from a number of people in the meeting quite consistently, is that he looked well, he looked cheerful. Some of them said that they joked with him. They asked him if he had had time to learn Russian, and apparently he found that amusing. And another person who was at the meeting said he spoke like a free man. So it sounds like his spirits are high and he's well-rested and well-fed and so forth.
NSA leaker and international fugitive Ed Snowden is still in a Moscow airport. He has met with human rights workers there and has requested temporary asylum in Russia, where he is now. Ellen Barry, Moscow correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Well, as Edward Snowden is meeting with those human rights officials, as you just heard, in the Moscow airport, the documents he leaked continue to make more headlines. The latest set of revelations published in the Guardian newspaper in the UK detail the extent to which Microsoft worked with the NSA to make data from Outlook and Hotmail and Skype accessible to the security agency. They also highlight the complicated regulations Silicon Valley executives run into as they try to make their products security compliant. Steve Blank is author of the online series and blog, The Secret History of Silicon Valley, at steveblank.com, and he joins me now. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Steve, Microsoft and other companies contended when the news of Prism first came out, the stuff that Ed Snowden leaked, that they didn't know what Prism was and they weren't cooperating. But that's far from the truth.
Yeah, it's one of these catch-22s. It turns out that the Patriot Act has a kind of a gotcha clause in there, Section 215, that says whoever gets that order from the government is prohibited from disclosing the fact that they got the order. So it's your First Amendment and your Fourth kind of go out with that.
So they all lied, but they were legally bound to lie, in other words.
It sure seems that way, doesn't it?
Okay. Well, let's drill down on Microsoft a little bit, because we're getting new details now about the extent to which Microsoft cooperated with the NSA to make its Outlook email client and certainly Hotmail, which we all know about, Skype, all more accessible to the NSA. Can you give us an idea of, sort of on the technical side, what exactly Microsoft did to make that easier? It must have been some hard decisions for them, or maybe it wasn't.
Well, you know, if you look at just the Prism slide, it shows Microsoft being the first provider of information to the NSA in September 11th, 2007. So they've been working with them since then. I think the most interesting thing is obviously they acquired Skype since then, and it appears that they've made that available. The other, which Skype promised would never happen. The other interesting thing was some of the comments that were released said they, in fact, bypassed the encryption completely and get at the plain text, which really means that there's stuff on your computer or there's ways that they're actually getting the data before it's encrypted. And that's a little frightening as well. Well, and by the way, if when they get Outlook, that means they're not only getting your email, they also have your calendar.
Your schedule.
Everything you're going to do. So right. It's not only what you did, but if they want to know where you're going to be, you just sent them kind of your next month.
Steve Blank, you and I are speaking on Skype right now. Skype was supposed to be unimpregnable by intelligence agencies. Not the case. What does it take to make a Skype chat listenable by a spy?
Well, you could either decrypt the stream, or you could just get at the unencrypted sides on your computer. And it looks like the Microsoft has given them access to be able to do that. I think the surprising thing was the amount of cooperation from Microsoft, not what NSA wanted to do, but in fact that these companies actively participated in doing this and then told us otherwise.
I want to ask you about that dynamic, because it's one thing to be ordered under the Patriot Act to get a national security letter or an order and then be legally bound to lie about it. Okay, you can face your customers on that issue. But how does Microsoft now sell security, sell privacy, sell encryption when it's so clear that those things are so easily circumvented with its help?
Well, it becomes a little harder after these disclosures, doesn't it? I think the takeaway for all Americans kind of after this disclosure is there isn't any type of communication you do in the United States that's yours, including anything on your smartphone, anything you put in the mail. I think the other disclosures that were equally troubling is every piece of mail, physical mail you put in the post office, is they take copies of the envelope and where it's going and who it came from. I think the other interesting thing for me was looking at the Prism slides is the NSA had, you know, legal firewall between them and these companies, because it was all going through a unit of the FBI. I just thought those slides were absolutely amazing on the both the breadth and the process that we're gathering all this data.
Right before we let you go, Steve Blank, you have made the remark that I've seen that we are beyond Orwell, in your view.
Yeah, it's you know, from a technologist's point of view, this is pretty sweet. We nailed every possible form of communication from technology, but you couldn't have written a science fiction story that had at least Americans waking up to find out that their Fourth and First Amendments are gone and that everything they do is being collected.
This is not science fiction, Steve Blank. This is real life, and this story is going to continue to be written. Steve Blank, author of the online series blog, The Secret History of Silicon Valley. You can read it at steveblank.com. Steve, thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Speaking of Microsoft, remember that sound? How does that make you feel? That, you know what that is. That's the startup sound from Windows 95. And we're trying to take you back a couple of decades here. We started a conversation yesterday about nostalgia, what it does to us and why sometimes it's good for us. You've been telling us about the music that makes you nostalgic and the memories that they bring for you. And this listener told us about the song that we're hearing right now.
My name is Wilfred Rivera. I'm from St. Cloud, Florida. And my favorite song of all time is The First True Love Affair. It's by Jimmy Roth. It reminds me of my wife.
A listener in Bel Air, Maryland writes, "The Platters, smoke gets in your eyes, slow dancing at the first boy-girl party. Heaven." We were inundated with your heavenly memories. Music seems to open the flood of those past moments.
Joan from New Jersey, Peter, Paul, and Mary would take me back to the 60s when I was in high school. Folk music, war protests, Vietnam, says it all.
Up the magic dragon, live by the sea, sing it with us and frolic.
This is Paul from Jersey City. The theme from the movie A Summer Place makes me think of some of the happiest times of my life. Summers of 1959, 1960, 1961. And even now, I use that theme as the ringtone on my mobile phone from the beginning of summer until winter.
Lots of you have those summertime memories.
This is Lorraine and Davey. My favorite song, especially this time of year, is The Boys of Summer by Don Henley. When I hear this song, I feel like I'm driving around with my top down.
A little voice inside my head said, don't look back, you can never look back. Thought I knew what love was, but did I know? Those days are gone forever.
There are 29,000 inmates in California on hunger strike this week, protesting that state's solitary confinement policies and prison overcrowding there. California holds some 4,500 inmates in solitary confinement, and the psychological and emotional effects of years in solitary can be devastating. Some researchers liken those effects to PTSD. So today we have two views on whether long stretches in solitary have a place in a 21st century prison system. In a moment, we're going to hear from the president of the New York State Correctional Officers and Police Benevolent Association, who says it does have a place. But first, Brian Nelson. Mr. Nelson spent 23 years in a 12-by-9 solitary confinement cell in Illinois before his release 3 years ago. He's here to share his memories of prison life and reflect on the difficulties of reentry to society. Brian, welcome.
Hello.
Brian, 23 years in a 12-by-9 cell, I can say it, but I can't really begin to get my head around what that means, and I was hoping you'd help us.
Basically, I lived in a tomb or a mausoleum in a cemetery. My cell was completely gray, the color of a tombstone. I could see nothing outside except a little slit of light at the top of the cell that's by the ceiling that I couldn't get up there and look out. And other than that, I had no human contact, no telephones. I didn't see TV for most of that time. Out of the 23 years, 21 of them, I never saw TV. And I was not in solitary confinement for violating prison rules. And another thing that may shock your listeners is out of the 300 men that were in this supermax solitary confinement prison with me, two-thirds of them were in prison for minor offenses, not murder. Some of these guys were there for DUI. Some were drug possession. They were placed in solitary confinement just because they need to fill these beds at times.
All right. Well, I wanted to ask you about that and ask you what crime you were convicted of that got you into prison in the first place.
I was convicted of, I pled guilty to a murder I did or was with somebody when it happened in 1982.
And what was your original sentence?
I was really sentenced to 26 years, and I was supposed to only do day for day of that 13 years.
And yet you spent 23 years in solitary confinement for a murder charge that you pled guilty to. Now, you said that you weren't in there for violating prison rules or bad behavior. As you understand it, why? I understand solitary for a couple of days or weeks when there's problems between inmates, of course, or punishment. 23 years. Help us understand why so long.
In 1998, Illinois opened a brand new Supermax prison, and they had nobody to put there. I was in a minimum security prison. My job was making officers' uniforms. I would walk out to their cars, put the uniform in their car, come back into the prison and give them their keys. Within 24 hours, I was taken from this environment and placed in TAM Supermax. And I was there for 12 years straight. And this was because I had won a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections years earlier, as from what I understand it. I wasn't, no disciplinary reports, no assaults. I wasn't assaulted. I had did nothing wrong. And when I arrived at TAM Supermax, they asked me why I was there.
All right. Well, Brian Nelson, you described the physical environment of solitary and how you got there, or maybe we don't know how you got there, perhaps. Can you help us understand your state of mind, what being in an environment like that does emotionally? I might be a little hard just to tell me kind of what it's like, but yeah, what's it like?
Okay, a little history. Prior to TAMS, I was never on any psychotropic medication in my life. I never had to see a psychiatrist in my life. I was in TAMS approximately 8 months before I was forced to start seeing somebody for mental health. I started pacing. I started getting depressed. I started just staring at the walls. I couldn't sleep. When I arrived at TAMS, I weighed roughly 176 pounds. The anxiety and the hopelessness got so bad at TAMS, I was pacing for 15 hours a day, according to the medical staff. And they used to have to bleed my feet every few weeks because I got blood blisters from walking so much. My weight at the lowest point got down to 110 pounds, and I'm 5'9". I lost the will to live sitting in that tomb. There was nothing to give my brain activity to think, to no social interaction. You're dead. You're just dead. And the sad part is I have faith in the Uptown People's Law Center filing a lawsuit gave us the hope that maybe something here could change. What I understand so much of what happened in California, we did the same hunger strike in TAMS. We just wanted to know, when will we get out of here? We wanted bilingual counselors and medical staff. We wanted the right to get an education because almost 99% of the prisoners in solitary confinement at TAMS had a release date. And by the time I got out of TAMS, they had me on four different types of psychotropic medication.
Do you think that solitary confinement has any legitimate role in these supermax prisons? Having experienced it, are there cases where it's appropriate, maybe apart from 23 years, but do you think it has a place?
Maybe for a calm down period. If somebody's just like on a rampage or just totally whacked out for like a set period of days, 10 days, 5 days. When TAMS opened, they said nobody would be there longer than a year because Warden Wilborn said nobody could survive this for years. And yet 15 years later, guys finally got out of there when TAMS closed. I mean, and here's our thing is we're Americans. We, most of us, are coming back out here to society. I'm so proud that I pay taxes. I did something wrong where I deserve to go to jail. and I admitted that, and I did my time. I'm not making up stories about it, but what happened to me and my family in there, my mom cried when she saw my cheekbones protruding. When I tried to kill myself, my family could not understand it because this just wasn't me. And I was found one day, my neck was so ripped up, I couldn't talk. And everybody's like, what happened? I said, I'm just tired. I don't want to do this no more. I don't want to sit here year after year with no hope of knowing I could ever get out of this gray box.
Brian Nelson, I want to thank you for sharing your story with us.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Well, we just heard from Brian Nelson, who spent 23 years in a 12-by-9-foot solitary cell. Some people say solitary confinement is there for a reason. It's a necessary tool for corrections officers. Prisoners are put into solitary for a reason. They're dangerous to their fellow prisoners and to the staff or to themselves. Don Rao is the president of the New York State Correctional Officers and Police Benevolent Association and an active corrections officer, and he joins me now from Albany. Hi, Don.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for being with us, Don. I know you heard the tail end of Brian Nelson's interview there where he described losing weight, blisters, pacing, psychotropic medications, depression, the loss of the will to live. Hearing all that, you believe that solitary confinement is necessary?
Yes, I do. I mean, we have a prison system that in New York that houses some of the most violent felony offenders in the country. Certainly more than 90% of those inmates do their time without incident, but there are presently 7% in disciplinary segregation for the purpose of them causing harm to others or themselves.
Brian Nelson, for one, and a lot of other people for that matter, stipulate that when prisoners are a danger to others or the staff or themselves or there are fights, that certainly solitary confinement is necessary and appropriate. But 23 years was his experience, and I wonder if in your experience there's a conceivable justification for such a long time alone in a cell.
The justification of their stay in a segregation unit is based on, of course, the violence that they committed within the system. Just as society has a code of conduct, so does a prison system in order to maintain the security of the facility. So that's looked at. Their behavior is looked at while they're in disciplinary segregation. Their time can be reduced with their behavior being appropriate while they're in disciplinary. But as far as an inmate staying in there for extended period of times, that remains on the inmate. Certainly an inmate who killed a correction officer, who killed a correctional staff member, that's going to be looked at time and time again. But in New York State, we review inmates' stays on at least a 6 month basis, if not more.
You have heard, I'm sure, news of the widespread hunger strikes, 29,000 inmates in California. I know that's on the other side of the country from you, but you're experienced in this world. How do you react to so many inmates across a state the size of California protesting these types of conditions? What does it make you think?
Again, I think we have to look at the with a bit of skepticism with the delivery of the message and who it's coming from. Prisoners are manipulative. They use the media. They use the court system, prisoner legal service, ACLU for their soapbox on issues, some that don't even exist. Certainly in New York here, an inmate in disciplinary segregation receives much more attention than an inmate would receive in general population. From medical staff, mental health staff, prison management, religious counseling, and so on and so forth.
All right. Well, Don Rao, president of the New York State Correctional Officers and Police Benevolent Association, thank you for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We always want to hear from you on this topic or others. Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE. You can reach us on the website with your comments at thetakeaway.org.
Meet George Jetson. is by Elroy.
Now that sounds a lot like 1962 or 63 or something like that, but it could tell us something important about 2062 or 2063. That's the Jetsons, of course, where George Jetson drops off his boy Elroy and daughter Judy and Jana's wife at their various places around town in little capsules that fly through the air. And as silly as it may seem, the capsule-based version of getting from A to B might not be that far off. Daryl Oster and his company ET3, that's Evacuated Tube Transport Technologies, are working on developing something called an evacuated tube system. Well, what does that mean? Daryl Oster of ET3 is here to tell us. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Daryl, you're in Colorado. I grew up there as a little kid, and I used to go to the bank with my parents to the drive-thru, and they had pneumatic capsules where you put your check in and it turns up on the other side. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's not a pneumatic system, but visually you can think of it the same way. I had experience when I was born in 62, and I grew up here in Colorado as well. I grew up on a farm, and my dad bought steel at the salvage yard, and they had a little glass pneumatic tube system that I watched when I was a little kid with fascination. And this system is similar. The car-sized vehicles operate in tubes that have all the air removed. Instead of a pneumatic propulsion, it uses electromagnetism, and the vehicles are magnetically levitated.
So this is similar to trains that I've seen called maglevs that actually kind of float on a thin cushion of air and magnets push and pull them at high speed.
Yes, exactly. Except instead of levitating a 100-ton locomotive, we're only levitating a vehicle that weighs 400 pounds but hauls the same 800-pound payload as a typical car. So it reduces the cost by more than an order of magnitude, a factor of 10.
And you could build these tubes in networks all over town, interstate? What are the limits here?
Yes, all over the world. If every place builds ET3 to the same standard, the same diameter tube, eventually it can be networked together in a global system across the Bering Strait that would allow you to go from New York City up across Canada, across Alaska, across the Bering Strait to Siberia, through Siberia. You would arrive in Beijing, China in 2 hours at about a tenth of the cost of flying.
And that means I'm traveling how fast?
That would be at 4,000 miles an hour.
Okay, but isn't my head slammed back against the seat and my face flattened out because I'm going so fast?
Well, almost any car on the road, if you step on the brakes full force, is about 1G of deceleration. Instead of just a few seconds of that acceleration to get up to interstate speed, extend that out for 3 minutes and you're going 4,000 miles an hour. And as a matter of fact, all of us on the Earth right now at this moment are going 67,000 miles an hour in orbit around the sun.
So it's the acceleration that makes you feel that way. If you go slowly up to speed to 4,000, you're fine once you get there, in other words.
Yes. We'll accelerate about at the rate that a sports luxury car like a Ferrari will accelerate initially, but we extend that out for 3 minutes instead of 5 or 6 seconds.
And he's seeing out the window. Is this an underground system you envision or glass and above ground?
Most of the system will be at speeds of 300 to 600 miles an hour and above ground. And the capsules will have screens and high definition video cameras on the tube. So you will be able to see where you're going, a view wherever you want or whatever visual input that you want.
Daryl Oster, founder and CEO of ET3. Daryl, who's first? I want to be first, but what's first? Boulder to Denver in 17 seconds? What's first?
Yeah, Boulder to Denver is really a really good route that we're looking at. It's roughly 30 miles, and that trip would take about 7 minutes.
Jeez, 7 minutes. Right now it takes a good hour.
And that would be at 375 miles an hour or so.
Well, the most elaborate habit trail ever built, or high-tech, high-speed transportation of the future. Daryl Oster, founder and CEO of ET3 in Colorado. Daryl, thanks so much. I can't wait.
Thank you.
Well, just a couple of months ago, in May, British businessman James McCormick was sentenced to 10 years in prison for the sale of fake bomb detectors. That's right. The gadget he sold was actually based on a fake golf ball finder and actually entirely unable to detect bombs in any way, or anything else for that matter. That detail didn't stop McCormick, though. He managed to sell 6,000 of these devices to the Iraqi government for a total of more than $38 million. It was a fraud on a massive scale. Listen to this BBC producer actually voicing the thoughts and words of a whistleblower to protect the whistleblower's identity. Listen.
Well, I said, if this really doesn't work, I can't be any part of it. He said it does exactly what it's designed to. I said, what's that? I was expecting him to say it detects explosives, ivory, gold. He never said that. He said, it makes money. I said, I want nothing more to do with it. He said, suit yourself, you're walking away from millions. I said, at least I can sleep at night, Jim.
Well, there's the voice of a BBC producer giving impressions of the story of a whistleblower who knew Jim McCormick. Adam Higginbottom is Bloomberg Businessweek reporter and writes about McCormick's rise and fall in the latest issue of the magazine, and he joins me now in studio. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
$38 million of fake devices. Like I said, it's a fraud on a massive scale. How did Jim McCormick approach this business? Where does he come from?
As far as the police could ascertain, he first came across these devices at some point in the late 1990s. But really got involved with it just before September the 11th. So just before the war on terror really got going. And, you know, the market for these kind of devices to detect explosives and help in the hunt for terrorists really got off the ground. But he spent a few years selling the devices that he had in ones and twos in kind of places around the world where procurement processes weren't that rigorous and where governments were pretty weak. In places like Mexico and Guatemala and Uzbekistan, for example, before he eventually got involved in Iraq. And he didn't get involved in Iraq until 2006. And the bulk of his sales went to Iraq. He sold around 7,000 of these things around the world over a 10-year period, but 6,000 of them went to Iraq.
And this was mostly Iraqi military and police?
Yeah, they were sold to the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior. But a subsequent investigation by the Inspector General in Iraq revealed that he spent about 75% of the total billing of these devices on kickbacks and bribes.
Was he a remarkable salesman? Was he a dynamic personality? What was his pitch like?
No, it would be nice to think that people fell for him because he was some kind of, you know, Donald Trump-style force in the boardroom or in meetings. But in actual fact, he seems to be not particularly articulate and certainly not particularly smart. He was garrulous and, by the accounts of some people I spoke to, knew how to put on a good party. But he was not an especially forceful salesman, but he had the right contacts and he paid a lot of bribes.
What did the devices look like when you saw them? Were they particularly convincing as a physical thing? Like, wow, this thing's got computers and readouts. It really looks convincing. I'm curious what it actually looked like when you held it in your hand.
No, I've got one of them at home because they were based on a novelty golf ball detector that was sold in the United States in the mid-90s.
So it looks like a box with a car antenna on it?
It's a plastic handle with a plastic hinge on it and a telescopic car antenna sticking out of it. And you hold it out in front of you, and the car antenna waves back and forth from side to side. And the direction it points in is the direction of your quarry.
Does it beep?
There are no electronics in it at all. They proudly proclaim that it requires no batteries, but operates purely on the static electricity generated by the human body.
Adam Higginbottom, I'm thinking of something else. This is a modern-day, big-money divining rod. That's all it is. This has been done before.
It is a divining rod. And in fact, James McCormick in one interview explained that it worked a bit like a dowsing rod. Although generally what he would say when asked how it worked was that he didn't know, but it just did.
And this device, this fake device, had some very real-world consequences for a lot of people. Here's Haneen Alwan, who had 59 operations after suffering burns in a double bomb blast in Baghdad in 2009. She spoke to the BBC as part of an investigation into these devices. Listen.
My life was completely destroyed. I lost everything in an instant. I was left with nothing. I lost the baby and my husband divorced me.
Adam Higginbottom, does Jim McCormick at this stage have any remorse? Does he have any connection to the consequences of his scam?
He insisted right up until the end that the devices worked exactly as he said they did and went to prison without expressing any remorse whatsoever because he continues, as far as I know, to insist that they work.
How could somebody like Jim McCormick get away with it for so very long? How could he have evaded law enforcement or just less credulous people for as long as he did?
I think because the principal sales for the device were in Iraq. And as far as the Western governments were concerned, you know, it was out of sight and out of mind. And his activity didn't really get seriously picked up until financial transactions coming in from the Middle East alerted the authorities in Britain, because they didn't know what the money was for, and the money was coming in such large quantities that this made them suspicious.
Well, Adam Higginbottom of Bloomberg Businessweek, after reporting this story, you've seen a lot of scams in your time. You've reported on a lot of things probably with war and business. Have you ever seen anything quite like this?
No. In fact, when I held one of the most expensive versions of the devices in my hand, one that was not originally designed as a golf ball detector, but the one that he sold for $30,000 ago, I couldn't quite believe that he had got away with it for so long, because the thing feels like it was manufactured by Fisher-Price.
A scam on the order of $38 million, not to mention lives lost and perpetrated in many, many countries around the world, particularly in Iraq. Adam Higginbottom is reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, telling us about the story of James McCormick, sentenced to 10 years in prison for selling fake bomb detectors. Adam, thank you.
Thank you.
From a fraud in Iraq to one of the most genuine voices of our time, Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai turned 16 today, but she's already seen a lot in her short life. Last October, Malala was shot in the head as she left her school in Pakistan. Members of the Taliban claimed responsibility, but they didn't silence Malala. Wearing a shawl that belonged to the late Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, Malala celebrated her 16th birthday with a speech at the United Nations today, and we wanted to play you a part of that speech now.
So here I stand, one girl among many. I speak not for myself, but for those without voice can be heard. Those who have fought for their rights. Their right to live in peace. Their right to be treated with dignity. Their right to equality of opportunity. Their right to be educated. Dear friends, on the 9th of October 2012, the Taliban shot me on the left side of my forehead. They shot my friends too. They thought that the bullet would silence us. But they failed. And out of that silence came thousands of voices. The terrorists thought that they would change my aims and stop my ambitions. But nothing changed in my life except this. Weakness, fear, and hopelessness died. Strength, power, and courage was born. My ambitions are the same. My hopes are the same. And my dreams are the same. Dear sisters and brothers, I'm not against anyone. Neither am I here to speak in terms of personal revenge against the Taliban or any other terrorist group. I'm here to speak up for the right of education of every child.
16-year-old Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai speaking today at the United Nations.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Friday is movie day here on The Takeaway, and that means our movie date team. We have two big blockbuster movies, potential blockbusters, coming out this weekend. We'll review them right here for you. Afterward, we're going to follow up on a conversation about Disney's Lone Ranger from last week. Johnny Depp is in the news again, this time for some philanthropy that we're going to hear about. But first, a buddy comedy, Grown Ups 2, featuring Adam Sandler, Kevin James, David Spade, and Chris Rock, hits theaters today. Also, a highly anticipated science fiction film, Pacific Rim, Robots and Monsters, opens up to audiences today as well. As always, our Movie Date team, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, are here to weigh in on both films. Rafer, of course, film critic for Newsday. Kristen is culture producer for The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hey, Todd.
Hey, Todd.
Always great to have you here. You can always subscribe to their podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Okay, as usual, we are going to start with trivia. Now, Kristen, I just want to note, people are starting to notice how few of these you get right. I just want to point that out. No pressure. But you're starting to get a bit of a reputation for not being able to get my trivia questions, even when they're not that hard.
You're just too hard. You're too hard, Todd.
Well, let's see how we do today and if you can change your reputation around. Chris Rock is one of the stars of Grown Ups 2, as I mentioned. Listen to this clip from one of Chris Rock's first films. It's a bit of an old one. And see if you can identify the film. Don't answer now. We're going to save the answer until the end. Here's Chris Rock.
How much for an order of ribs?
$2.50.
So I guess that's about 50 cents a rib, huh? Let me get one.
One order of ribs.
No. One rib.
One rib.
I sure am hungry.
This is Chris Rock from a movie. I'll give you a hint. It is from the 80s. One of his first films. I'm getting quizzical looks, but you might have it by the end. All right, file that one away. Let's start off with Grown Ups 2. As I mentioned, Chris Rock, David Spade, Adam Sandler, Kevin James. Let's hear a clip.
Look at this. Beers on ice. Hot ladies everywhere. This is how we used to do it.
This is Kappa Eta Sigma property.
Who?
So you might want to quit perving on our ladies and get back to your trailer homes.
Okay, easy there, Abercrombie.
Haven't been around this many arrogant white college kids since Eminem played Duke.
Rafer Guzman, my general rule in life, Adam Sandler's a big red light that I do not cross. He's in it. I don't go. Chris Rock is a green light, so I'm torn here.
Well, that was Taylor Lautner from Twilight that you heard in that clip. And I think you know you're in trouble when Taylor Lautner is the funniest person in the film.
Oh, dear.
This was, I thought, a really, really bad comedy from Adam Sandler on par with Jack and Jill and That's My Boy and other disasters.
They're all disasters you're describing.
It's a lot of toilet humor and none of it's funny. Nick Swardson is in it, who's really highly unwelcome as this really gross, mentally ill character. I just found the whole thing, for a movie that's supposed to be about family and friends and hometown and this kind of warm, fuzzy feeling, I found the whole thing really unpleasant and dirty and unlikable.
Kristen Meinzer, is there anything about Grown Ups 2 that you can redeem?
I do have to agree that Taylor Lautner is hilarious in it. The Jay Giles band makes an appearance at a wild party.
Awesome.
But other than that, it's just, you know, it's a day in the life of a bunch of middle-aged guys who love their wives and want a party, and that's about it. And it's perfectly fine if you have nothing else to watch, but I wouldn't recommend it as a destination movie.
Right. Well, I have plenty of other better things to do, especially, I hate to say it, when Adam Sandler's involved. I would have taken yes for an answer since Chris Rock is in it, but I guess not. Let's move on to Pacific Rim, director Guillermo del Toro. This is takes place in the future in the 2020s when colossal monsters called kaiju are attacking the Earth. Now, I'm familiar with the concept of kaiju through Kaiju Big Battle and monster battles and stuff like that, you know, Japanese monsters fighting in cities. So let's listen to a clip.
What the hell do you want a secondary brand for anyway? I mean, every part of the kaiju sells. Cartilage, spleen, liver, even the crap. But the brain, too much ammonia. So what's the deal, little fella?
Well, that's classified. So I couldn't tell you, even if I wanted to. But it is pretty cool.
Guys, I can urge people who don't know what kaiju is to check it out and look for kaiju on YouTube, monsters fighting in a wrestling ring. Do I want to see it on a grand electronic blockbuster scale, Kristen?
I am going to say something no one's going to expect. Yes, absolutely. Really? You should see this. Yeah. I laughed and laughed and laughed when I first saw the trailers and the headlines. In order to fight monsters, we had to create monsters. And I thought, this is ridiculous. But humans, they get together. They build these giant robots to fight the giant monsters. The giant robots are called Jaeger, as in Jägermeister. And
fantastic.
People have to operate these robots. You have to have a team of two people in each one.
Takes cooperation.
It does. It does take cooperation internationally and between humans to fight these monsters. And a lot of it's just visually fantastic because Guillermo del Toro, who you may remember from Pan's Labyrinth, just makes things so beautiful. So I'd recommend it.
Rafer, kaiju in Pacific Rim?
The more you're talking about it, the dumber that movie gets to me. I'm flashing back to how stupid that film was. It really, I think the only people that are going to see this are going to be huge kaiju fans or people under six. I really can't see anybody else sitting through this film.
And there's actually not a great deal of overlap between those two groups.
No, I don't think there is.
So really a no-go for most sentient adults.
Yes, I really thought this film was an absolute disaster.
I am a kaiju fan. I may go. I may not spend full price to see it. We'll have to see. All right, I wanted to move on to some other news that we mentioned. We were talking about Johnny Depp's portrayal of Tonto in The Lone Ranger for the last couple of weeks and some of the reaction to it. Now, Johnny Depp, Kristen Meinzer, is making other news in this regard with what? What's he up to?
Well, he has offered to buy the Wounded Knee land, which in South Dakota, there's been a battle over what to do with this land. The man who owns it was offering to sell it to the Lakota tribe for a huge exorbitant amount of money, and they couldn't afford it. And then he had a deadline where he was going to put it up for sale to the general public. But this week, Johnny Depp's reps reached out to the Lakota tribe and said, you know what? The man who owns the land, we're going to buy it from him and we're going to give it to you. And I talked with the tribe this week and they said nothing is in writing yet, but this conversation has definitely happened.
Now, is this the kind of thing that Johnny Depp would have been planning all along, or is this an overt reaction to the criticism he got as a white guy for playing a Native American in Lone Ranger?
Well, if it's the latter, I'm just going to quote something that Rafer said to me. It's not going to improve ticket sales.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. Okay, well, message received. It's still a comment on the quality of Lone Ranger there. All right, a little bit of Johnny Depp news that we got there in the Lakota tribe. Let's go back to trivia now. I played for you a clip of Chris Rock from one of his first films. I'll give you a hint from 1988. Listen again.
No. One rib.
One rib.
I sure am hungry.
The famous one rib scene. It's gotten to be a bit of a classic. Kristen Meinzer, what is the name of that film?
Oh my God, is it Being There?
Kristen Meinzer extends her reputation of not being able to get my trivia questions. Rafer, sometimes you get them.
I'm not going to do much better. I'm going to take a stab and say House Party.
Not a bad guess. I'm going to get you Sucker. Directed and produced by Keenan Ivory Wayans, which he starred in, Chris Rock, and lots of other actors. Jim Brown, a classic. I love that movie, 1988. Sorry, guys. Rafer Guzman, movie critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer at the Takeaway, our movie date team. Sorry you didn't get it, but thanks for stopping, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, here's a reminder. If you want to catch up on the movies or listen back to anything you've heard on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. And we always want to hear from you. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE, and we're on Twitter at The Takeaway. We know that we've got a lot of people listening to us for the first time, and we thank you for your company. We hope you have a terrific weekend. Your real host, John Hockenberry, will be here on Monday, and I hope that you can join him then. I will be back in Washington, D.C. as correspondent doing my regular job. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.